Please do take your Bibles in hand or scroll on your devices to Exodus chapter 2 this evening, where we're going to find words that we're going to study later in our service. Exodus chapter 2, we're going to read the whole of this chapter, reminding ourselves that what we are reading is the living word of the living God. Verse 1 of chapter 2. Now a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. So the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in the land of Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" Reuel asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man who gave him his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I've become a foreigner in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. We're going to leave our reading there for the moment. We will return to it later in our service. Please do take your Bibles in your hands and turn again to Exodus chapter 2, words that we read earlier on in our service. Exodus chapter 2. Perhaps over the years you've heard different reports introduced for us in the media that speak about children born at the same time, born in different worlds, as it were. People talk about the potential of a child or their life's chances. Not a particularly great term, but it's a term that they use. A child born at the same time in sub-Saharan Africa or a child born in Germany. And their life, the potential of their life, the chances of their life are going to be impacted by such differing social and economic circumstances. And so the life chances of a child born in sub-Saharan Africa is so much less than a child born in Germany. Well, if we were to take that, you know, imperfect analogy and apply it to Moses, then we would think that the potential for this child whose birth is described for us in Exodus chapter 2, that the life chances that this child had were next to nothing. Because this child was born into an environment where the successive policies of the government had gone from hard slavery for the people of God to infanticide, where the young boys would be killed at birth. And when Moses comes into the equation, the official government policy of the day is that of genocide. That if any one of the Egyptian people will see any young Hebrew babies, any young Hebrew toddlers, then throw them into the Nile. So this is somebody who was born into a world of cruelty, a world of pain, a world of slavery and despair. He's born under a sentence of death. And so this is the cheery place that we begin tonight as we embark on the start of Exodus chapter 2. This is the environment in which Moses was born. And so we're going to work through this chapter this evening to see what God says to us through the details of this chapter, and then summarize with a few principles at the very end of the teachings that are salient from a passage like this. Let's unpack a little bit more about this young family that we meet here in verse 1. So the man of the tribe of Levite married a Levite woman, became pregnant, gave birth to a son. And so there's a young Hebrew family here. They already have two children. We know one's called Miriam and one is called Aaron. And you can imagine the grown-ups doing what grown-ups do, trying to engage the kids. Oh, and is it a boy or is it a girl that you want? And you can imagine the sharp intake of breath when one of them says, oh, I'd love a younger brother. Younger brother? Well, that's a sentence of death. And so as they hear about the younger brother, as Moses, as Miriam or Aaron speak of, yeah, we'd love a younger brother, then Moses' parents kind of look at each other and think, well, what will we do? And so the child is born. And the first words spoken about a child tend to be, it's a boy or it's a girl. And it was a boy. And immediately the high of this child being born, then this cloud descends and they start looking at each other and they say, now, shush, you need to keep this quiet. We don't want too many people knowing about this because there's a sentence of death hanging over him. And so began the roller coaster that Moses' parents would have been on for these 3 months. The night that we took our first child home from Rigmore, she didn't just cry. She screamed all night. At 3 o'clock in the morning, our dog at the time came into the sitting room and delivered the loudest canine sigh that I've ever heard in my life at the noise. Because newborns make noise. And yet noise is the very thing that's most dangerous for Moses' life, for his parents, for the family. Because they need to try and keep him quiet. And so the noises that the neighbors must have been hearing throughout the night, and they speak the next day, did we hear some noises? Oh, it was just the cattle. Oh yes, Aaron's been having some very strange dreams at night. We're trying to reassure Aaron, but he just starts crying, and it's very like a child, very like a baby's cry. And who knows what they may have been coming up with. But they knew that the time had come. They knew the time had come that they could hide him no longer by the time verse 3 comes along. And whether they were given a tip-off of impending searches, or whether they thought there was somebody within the environment who was a traitor, they knew that they had to do something. And so they came up with a plan. And the plan involved a degree of reconnaissance, trying to ensure that they knew something about the behavior, the conduct of Pharaoh's daughter. And so they came up with this plan, verse 3, when she could hide him no longer, she got this papyrus basket, coated it with tar and pitch, placed it, the child in it, put it among the reeds, sister stood back, then Pharaoh's daughter came along. And so we see an image here that is almost heartbreaking, isn't it? Can you imagine the emotional intensity of Moses' mother? For what may be, in her mind, the very last time she's holding her child. and she's taking him and she's placing him into this basket that's been made as waterproof as possible. And she knows that the likelihood of this plan working is just minimal, but she's holding her precious child, and is this the last time she's going to hold him? And then she has to put him in the basket, put the blanket over him, and she has to turn and she has to walk away. Now, some of us as parents know what it's like when we've had to leave our young children to go for general anaesthetic in hospital. We know that there's been a plan. We know it's been necessary. We know the risks are minimal. But we also know what it's like to turn around and to walk away, knowing that we've left our child there. And we know the risks are minimal, but our minds are still going on about the what ifs. And if you've been there, you know how costly that is. But even that is nothing compared to what Moses' mother was going through, because she knew that barring a divine intervention, then her son was going to be drowned. And so the kids' picture books, Bibles that tell us and give us the images of Moses here in this little basket, they don't tell anything about the emotional intensity of what that scene was actually trying to convey. Nor do they mention anything about the faith that was shown. And you say, faith? Where was faith shown? And that's where we are directed back into the New Testament, into the letter to the Hebrews. In chapter 11 it says, by faith Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born, because they saw he was no ordinary child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. Now that last bit tells you that there was a faith that they had that had the correct proportion of the situation that they were in. That they feared God more than they feared Pharaoh's decrees. And they knew that when she held her child, and when they held their child, that this was not just a beautiful child, because I mean every child is beautiful in the eyes of its parents, but that there was something about this child, and that they knew this was a child, this was a gift given to them by God, and so they had a trust in God. Now we don't know the full analysis of their faith, but we do know that certain elements would have been present. So for instance, as the people of God who feared God more than Pharaoh, they would have been people who would have known about God's promises. Throughout the book of Genesis, various promises were given by God to his people that they will go down to Egypt, but God, in chapter 46 of Genesis, verse 4, I will bring you back again. It's a promise repeated in chapter 48. The people of God knew that at some point God was going to take them back out of Egypt. They knew also that a promise had been given that to Abraham that for 400 years they'd be enslaved. And so there were certain things that were there. And now this gift, this very precious special gift is there. And so this faith that they have, it's not something that they have somehow generated from within, because none of us can generate a living faith in God from within. It's something that's given to us. It is a gift of God. They had faith. And so, having been directed and guided to this plan, the plan worked to perfection, didn't it? It's almost as if there's a degree of amazement and humor in this plan. What Moses' mother is actually going to get paid to bring up her child. This is remarkable. What an amazing turn of events. Well, it's no stroke of luck. The sovereign hand of God was over Moses at this point in his existence. And so he was brought back into the family home, and he was there long enough to learn that he belonged to the people of God. And it's not as if he spent his entire childhood there. Most people think that he would still have been relatively young by the time he was adopted into the royal family, as it were, at that point. But he was there long enough to have it instilled within him from his mother's knee that he was part of the people of God. Something that did not leave him. And so, in many ways, we could say with Moses that the destiny of nations is impacted by the parental care, embedding into the lives of young boys and young girls, of the acknowledgement of the presence of God, of the control of God, and of the necessity to trust in this God throughout our lives. You see, parenting today, well, as it has probably ever been thus, that it is this chaotic, mad rush, mad dash. There's so many things that have to be done, isn't there? And we don't doubt that school is important, it is. And we don't doubt that extracurricular activities have their place, they do. And yet all the busyness and all the frenetic activity, it's done what in the past couple of generations in our country? It's meant the actual time that we've got to embed within the minds and hearts of our children that they belong to the people of God, that time has been reduced and reduced and reduced. You see, the greatest thing that we can give to our kids or to our grandkids, if that's the stage of life that you're at, the greatest thing that we can give to them is by our word and by our witness, remind them of the presence and of the power of the God who has a claim upon their hearts. That's what Moses' parents were doing here. And so our next introduction to Moses is given to us in verse 11. And some 40 years have passed between verse 10, when Moses' world was turned upside down, when he went from living as part of a slave family to now being part of the palace, to now begin his education in the finest education system the history of the world knew at that point. When his world was turned upside down, we are then introduced 40 years later to Moses, and we're introduced to him. Despite all of the education, all of the privilege that he's had, our first introduction to Moses as a grown-up is where he fails dramatically. And he joins what we would possibly say would be a couple of lists of individuals that he would naturally fit into. We could include people of our own generation, as it were. He would be in a list alongside Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and J.K. Rowley, those who early on in their careers were people who experienced failure. It's quite humorous to think now that there was one publisher who advised J.K. Rowling to enroll in a writing course because they didn't think she had any ability. And so they knew what it was to experience failure in their early career, as it were, as they stepped out in their chosen path. That's exactly what the words here tell us about, that Moses knew some failure as well. He's somebody who's beginning to understand that he has a distinct role. He's got a vision. He's got a passion for the people of God, for the things of God. He recognizes that his people are in slavery and he wants to do something about it. He's got the vision, he's got the passion, he wants now to act. But when he acts, it's not as if the people are lining up behind him because they're catching his vision and they're seeing his passion. No, they're keeping their distance because they don't want trouble, and Moses is trouble, and Moses is causing trouble. And so he finds himself in big trouble. And he finds himself in another list. If he's one who failed early on in this passion, this vision that he has, he finds himself in another list of people who had to learn in the Bible to wait. We began our worship this evening with that hymn based on the words of Psalm 120 that reminds us that there will be many times in the life of faith that we need to wait. We want to act, we want to fix, we want to resolve, we want to do. And yet time and again, God will ask us to wait. And whether it's Abraham and Sarah who were told that they were going to have a son, but they were having to learn to wait. Like Moses, they take matters into their own hands. Does it end well? No, it doesn't. It causes all manner of difficulties. Joseph has to wait 22 years for the dreams that God has given to him to actually come to pass. Habakkuk, as he cries out in a violent, unjust generation, cries out for God to intervene, has to wait for an answer. The disciples, after Jesus has risen from the dead, he's been teaching them for 40 days, and he's about to ascend to heaven, and he says, are you going to restore the kingdom now? No, you need to wait. And he's learning, and he's going to learn that God's timing is different to his timing. And how frequently that's a lesson that we need to learn and to relearn, that God's timing is different to our timing. Thankfully, God's timing is different to our timing. Because if actions were to happen or troubles were to be resolved in our timing, can you imagine the consequences? So perhaps you are the visionary tonight. Perhaps you are the guy with a passion. Perhaps you are the woman who understands the way forward. And you don't understand why nobody's kind of joining you in this. Well, perhaps the passion and the vision are right. But perhaps the timing's not. Because there is a time that God has set, and there's a time that we sometimes need to learn to wait. For Moses, though, this is not simply a time to wait. It was for him, crucially, it was a time to decide. Was he going to be this Egyptian prince, this potential candidate to be the next Pharaoh? Or was he going to be among the people of God? And he has to make that decision. The description of what happens from verse 11 onwards means his time for pondering that whole issue is over and done with. And no doubt he has heard many sniggering stories of how the Egyptians coming back and hanging about the palace and how they dealt with these pesky Hebrew people. Oh, you should have seen what one of the guys did to him today. You should have seen the punishment that was meted out. The poor wimp just keeled over and died. That's the type of people we've got to work with. And he would remember the laughs. He would remember the sniggering faces. Perhaps he would see occasionally these Hebrew slaves walking past with all manner of bruising and cuts all over their faces. But today, it's right in front of him. Because today it says, in verse 11, he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. He had meandered out to where the slaves were, and he's seen now for himself the injustice of what's taking place. And so now, it's a decision time. Because somebody's life is going to depend on this decision. And the decision that he made, again, Hebrews chapter 11 fleshes that decision out for us. In Hebrews chapter 11, it tells us, verse 24, by faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt. The decision was made. And the riches and the privileges, the treasures, the pleasures of Egypt were going to be put to one side, where the hardship of following those of the family of faith was going to be his decision. We don't know in many ways what had happened in the run-up to this, how the dissatisfaction with the pleasures and treasures of Egypt began to grow in his life. But we do know it got to that point that he realized that actually the pleasures and the treasures of this world, that doesn't cut it. That does not connect with the deepest needs that he has. And so he's putting them to one side. And he is going to follow in that path of faith, along with the people of faith. The time for decision has now come. It's not as if he's making this monumental sacrifice. I mean, his contemporaries would have thought so. They would think Moses was utterly bonkers. Why would he throw away his life for following after the faith of this group of slaves? But Moses knew he wasn't bonkers. Was it that famous quote by Jim Elliot, who was a missionary in South America, that he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. The treasures and pleasures, he can't keep them. None of us can. You see, in this world, whatever treasures and pleasures we have, and whatever satisfaction we get from them, it's fleeting. It doesn't last. What does last is what our Maker has provided for us to meet that deepest need that we have. And that is to know Him. And so tonight, in many ways, if Moses is typifying that moment of decision, well, tonight is a time of decision for you. Tonight is a time of decision. It's a time where the pondering as to whether or not I'm going to respond to the call of Jesus Christ to follow or not. It's time for decision because someone's life depends on it. And you say, well, whose life depends on it? Your life depends on it. Your eternity depends on it. Because while you have the voice of God speaking through the word of God, calling you to himself, that is the time that a decision needs to be taken. Of realizing that the pleasures and treasures of this world will actually merely lead you to a lost eternity. Rather, as Jesus says, why not rather store up treasures in heaven where moth and vermin cannot destroy? Because where your treasure is, says Jesus, that's where your heart will be also. There's a time for decision. Because the time for indecision is passing very, very quickly. What will it be for you? And so we work our way through the passage and we realize that and come to our final teaching, as it were, for this evening, where we encounter again the truth that failure is not final with God. There's probably very few of us who don't live with one type of wound or scar from failure in our lives. If you haven't accrued such by this point, it may come your way at some point soon. And when we experience failure, it can be absolutely crippling. It can be paralyzing. And we can find it almost impossible to move on from our failure. And even when we know other people might never move on from our failures, we ourselves struggle to move on from them. And so as we are presented in the Word of God with the example of Moses here, we are learning in Moses, and we will learn it with others through the Bible, that failure is never final when it comes to God. Because God is one who can deal with our failures. If you were to stop reading about the account of Moses at the end of chapter 2, you would think that he is among the least likely people to ever become the giant figure of the Old Testament. Because his failure is a massive failure. He is somebody who is, it's not a small blip, it's an epic crater that he has caused. Somebody has lost their lives because of what he has done. Now, somebody could argue, well, the Hebrew was about to lose his life by what the Egyptian was doing. But that's still semantics. Somebody has lost their life because of Moses' impatience. And Moses has to now somehow live with this. And in the light of how it becomes known, he has to flee. And he's out living now in a foreign land. And just as Joseph was in a foreign land and he has children in a foreign land, Joseph's names of his children are slightly different. They're Godward focused because he knows that even in a foreign land, God is with him. But Moses is different. He's a foreigner in a foreign land. That's what he names his son. And for him, it's almost as if have ties been cut. Is any opportunity for him to do the good that he somehow has his consciousness that something is pointing in this direction for him? Is it just over with him and God? No, it's not. Because God is going to use him in a remarkable way. And so we're left asking, why is it that God allows his people to fail? Because it's not as if Moses was doing this before he came to this great decision as to whether or not to side with the people of God to follow the life of faith or stay an Egyptian. It's after he's made this decision. He's on the path of faith. And it's on the path of faith that he makes this massive mistake. And sometimes we think, well, you know, we think, and who are we in comparison to God? But we think, well, wouldn't it be easier if these leaders didn't make these mistakes?
Wouldn't it be a better thing for the unfolding message of God if these leaders didn't fall, if Moses didn't have an issue with alcohol, and if David didn't have an issue with his lust taking a hold of him and ending up in, with another man's wife in his bed and conspiring to kill the Bathsheba's husband? I mean, would it not be better if God somehow just didn't allow these guys to do that? And yet failure is the soil in which we often learn lessons that we could never learn if the people of God always lived successfully, whatever that might be. Moses is going to learn here that he's nothing without God. It doesn't matter what education he's had, it doesn't matter what privileges he's had, it doesn't matter what vision or passion or gifts or talents, he's nothing without God. A lesson that every single one of us need to learn. Apart from me, says Jesus, you can do nothing. And it's not by might and it's not by power, but God also reminds us by his Spirit that he accomplishes his work. And so Moses is going to learn here. He's going to learn here about the capacity in his own heart for sin. Just as every one of God's people who has failed learns the capacity that we have in our own hearts for sin. You know, there is in our heart, there is the capacity for every single sin to be harbored there and to be acted upon. And it's often in times of failure that we realize these things and the capacity of our sin to lead, the capacity of our heart to lead us astray. And so we marvel, therefore, do we not, when we meet somebody like Moses, and when we meet people like Noah and like David and others, do we not then marvel when we think of the God who entered this world in a time of cruelty and pain, entered a world of slavery and despair, entered a world under a sentence of death, where Herod is there ready and waiting to kill him before he can even get through these early months and years of his life? Is it not remarkable that we encounter in Jesus Christ one in whom there was no need for failure as that sense, in that sense, because there was no need for pride to somehow be exposed in order to be dealt with? There was no need for Jesus' heart to be exposed to lust or whatever that might have been there in order to be dealt with before he would go on this public ministry. There was no need for any of that, because his heart was perfectly, piercingly pure. And this life, this ministry that he fulfilled, it was one that he embarked on exactly in sync, in the correct timing with his father. And throughout the various stages of his life and then of his ministry, he is at one with his father in this purpose. He's not running ahead. He's not delayed. He is at one. Why? Because he's living that perfect life that no leader could ever live, that no person could ever live, that no man or woman, boy or girl of the family of faith could ever live. He's lived it in that mission to come and deal with sin once and for all. He's lived it. And so that's why, as we see time and again, to people who are from the outside looking in and they look at perhaps the glaring hypocrisy that some of us may have and may live through in our lives, and we say, yeah, that's exactly what I'm like. But don't look at me. Look at one who's never been hypocritical and never will be. One who will never let you down. One that you will never somehow find something out at some stage in your knowledge about him that will let you down. Fix your eyes on Jesus. He's the one who calls you to follow him. He's the one who will keep you always. And so a passage like this reminds us, does it not, of the importance of teaching our young ones from the earliest days of the God who has come into this world for them. The God who has a claim on their hearts. A passage like this reminds us that our upbringing does not define us. Whether our upbringing has been under the greatest shadow and has been so compromised, or whether our upbringing has been as privileged as it possibly could be. Our upbringing does not define us. Because what defines us is our relationship with God. And our failure does not define us. Because our failure with God is never final when repentance is the response to it. And so chapter 2, a passage that seems to be thousands of years away from our lives tonight, and yet is so highly relevant to some of the challenges, some of the issues that we have. What a big issue identity is today. What a big issue identity is today, and people will go back to their childhood, or they will live in the conscious of the negative impact of failure. And a passage like this says, listen, you are not your failure. You are not your upbringing. Your life can be defined in your response to Jesus Christ, who loved you, failure and all, and gave himself for you, so that by following him, you will know what it is to be welcomed home once and for all in him. We'll finish there.